You're listening to the Tutten Children Podcast.
Okay, so let's start with our motivation. So sometimes in our study and practice of the Dharma, we hear different teachings and we think, that's too much for me. I can never attain that. I can never do that. And yet, if somebody asks us, do we think attaining that or doing that is possible for human beings, we say, yes. Why? Well, the Buddha said so, you know, and the Buddha did it himself. And then, if we ask the person, why don't you think you can do it? They give some sort of reason. But then you say, but the Buddha said that all of us have the potential to do it. So what you're saying is contradictory. On one side you say that you believe that these things are possible because the Buddha spoke them and you trust the Buddha. But when the Buddha said that you're capable of doing it, then you don't believe him. Getting what I'm saying? That. So it's kind of contradictory. We believe the Buddha in one instance, but we don't believe him in the other. So I think we have to make our thoughts a little bit more cohesive, you know, not so unbalanced. And if we trust the Buddha's pronouncements, in one area, maybe trust him when he's saying that we are capable too. Okay? And so especially when the Buddha says that we have the potential to become fully awakened, then we have the potential to generate bodhicitta, to realize emptiness. So that doesn't necessarily mean we'll be able to realize these things tomorrow. But when we put in effort, then definitely causes create effects, and the effects will one day come. So let's put in our effort to learn and practice Buddha's teachings for the benefit of all beings. So it's interesting, isn't it, how inconsistent we are? Yeah. I believe the Buddha when he says that it's possible to generate equal-hearted love and concern for all sentient beings. But I don't believe him when he said I can do it. You know? It's really rather silly. So, We're talking a little bit about how the self-centered thought works. And this is a very good example of it. You know, how it causes these kinds of inconsistencies. Because when we lack self-confidence, what is it that is behind that? It's not wisdom, is it? You know, it's self-centeredness. Everybody else can do it. But not me. Yeah, because I'm the worst. We've lived our whole lives like that, and it hasn't gotten us anywhere. So maybe we should try believing in ourselves, and we should try believing in other people's potentials too. Yeah, because if you think about it, remember the story of Angulimala? Who had killed 999 people and was on the way to kill his 1,000th person, because he had met Charlatananda, who told him, bring me the finger, you know, joints of 1,000 people. So, you know, Angulimala wasn't somebody you wanted to meet in a dark alley, or even on the street. Yeah. And yet, when the causes and conditions were right, his mind completely switched, and he was able to become an arhat in that life. Yeah. The townspeople still screamed when they saw him. Yeah. He sometimes had a hard time getting alms. They didn't want to come near. But the Buddha said, listen, you have to bear it. This is a result of your karma ripening. But still, he was able to attain liberation. So, certainly we're not that bad. Although somebody's going to say, you don't know me, I am. I'm worse than Angulimala. But that you're going to have to prove. Okay, please prove that. Okay. So we finished chapter 2 last week, didn't we? We're starting chapter 3, or, you know, section 3, the third section, which is the collections for awakening. Okay. So you'll remember, I think it was verse 193 and 194, when the Buddha talked about when Nagarjuna talked about the three main causes to attain awakening, to become a bodhisattva, and then from being a bodhisattva to become awakened, what were they?
Bodhicitta.
Compassion. Non-dual wisdom. Okay. And so, those are the three things we have to really, you know, put our focus on generating. And as we practice these three, okay, what we do is we collect merit and we collect wisdom. Okay? And so those three are like the three causes for a bodhisattva. And then as a bodhisattva, we really put our energy to fulfill the two collections of merit and wisdom. Okay? And so these collections are only possessed by bodhisattvas. Yeah? So here, solitary realizers don't have these, because to be a collection of merit, it has to be supported by the wisdom realizing emptiness. To be the collection of wisdom, it has to be supported by bodhicitta. Okay? So actually, to fulfill any of the six paramitas, you know, you have to have the support of both bodhicitta and some form of wisdom. You know, we don't have that wisdom now, but we practice, you know, like when we make offerings or when we do something kind or whatever, we practice, you know, having the motivation of bodhicitta and then thinking of the action, the act, and the object as empty and yet dependent. Okay? So, now we're going to start. So, as we often find, first the Nagarjuna says to the king, okay, time to wake up and listen. You know, maybe you were falling asleep by the time we reached the end of the 32 signs and 80 marks of the Buddha. So now he's saying, listen, great king, to the way in which the signs of a Buddha arise from an inconceivable amount of merit according to the great scriptures of the universal vehicle. So universal vehicle means Mahayana. Okay, so he's going to talk about how the signs of a Buddha arise from the inconceivable merit. That, and as this is taught in the Mahayana scriptures. Now, I have to say something about the word inconceivable, okay? So, inconceivable means it's beyond our ability to conceptually grasp it. It's beyond our ability to think about it and come to a final something about the amount of merit. But it doesn't mean infinite. So in the next section, we will hear the words boundless, immeasurable, incalculable, limitless. But we're not going to hear infinite. Okay? Because all those ones, boundless, countless, limitless, it means you can't count it. The number's too high. Yeah? But, of course, there is a limit. Because if there weren't a limit, you know, I mean, it's limitless in that you can't count it, but it's not infinite, because if the merit were infinite, then you could never finish collecting it and get the result. Okay? So same thing when we talk about the number of sentient beings. They're countless. They're inconceivable. But we don't, you know, some people may say infinite, but infinite becomes confusing. Because if they're infinite, then you know, you never get to the end. So yes, there is a finite number of sentient beings, but it's so huge that we can't think about it or count it or calculate it or something like that. Okay? So it's the same whenever he talks about like the merit that we need to create to become a Buddha. It's, you know, enormous. In that same way. But then when he talks about the benefits of bodhicitta and how bodhicitta can help us create that merit, that's equally boundless, countless, inconceivable. Okay? So we sometimes take, when we hear the amount of merit, you know, limitless and three countless great eons, how long is that, you know? It's like, and then we just go, okay, it's too much, it's infinite, it's too much, you can't do it. Yeah, but that's not the point, because we also have a method that creates boundless, incalculable, limitless, inconceivable merit. Yeah, okay. So, in the previous chapter, we heard the specific verbal and physical actions that were needed to create, to attain the 32 signs of a Buddha. And but we didn't hear how much virtue or for how long we need to practice to cultivate it. And so now he's going to talk about this by relying on the Universal Vehicle Scriptures. So, verse 202 and 203, a single pore of a Buddha is made from 10 times the following amount of merit. Okay, the total merit from which all solitary realizers have arisen, the total merit that produced all learners and those beyond learning, and the total merit of the entire universe, which is like the universe, the total merit of the entire universe, which like the universe is measureless. Okay, all of that, each pore of a Buddha likewise arises from that much merit. Okay, so single pore, you know, like the, I mean, like the hair pores, you know, just here and here and wherever. Okay. Probably this pores of the skins where we don't have hair too, isn't there? Yeah. So all the pores, okay. So first you have to take all the merit from all the solitary realizers. Yeah. And then the total merit produced by all learners and those beyond learning. Learners means those who are on the path. Beyond learning means those who have attained the result. Okay. So we have to add together all the merit needed to produce each and every solitary realizer, each and every hearer, okay, as well as the meritorious karma that to produce each and every rebirth as a human being, and each and every rebirth as a in the God realm as a celestial being. Okay. And then the total merit of the universe, there's a lot of merit there, and then you multiply that by 10. Okay. And that's the amount of merit needed to attain just one pore of the Buddha. And the Buddha has numberless pores. Okay, so that's a lot. Then, 204 and 205, a single mark of a Buddha, so these are of the 80 marks, of a Buddha is obtained through 100 times the amount of merit needed to produce all of a Buddha's pores. Okay. King, that amount of merit completes one auspicious mark. Likewise, from that amount of merit arises each of them up to 80. Okay, so the amount that we just talked about, all the merit of the hearers and the solitary realizers, the learners and the arhats, and all the merit in the universe, times 10, that's to produce one pore. Then when you think of how many pores the Buddha has on his body, okay, so then you multiply that okay, so the single mark is obtained through 100 times the amount of merit needed to produce all the Buddha's pores. Okay, so that number times all the Buddha's pores, which are, I don't know how many, some one of the countless numbers, and then you multiply that by 100, and that's the amount of merit to attain one of the 80 marks. Okay, and so, you know, so for each of them, that's much, that's how much merit you need to create. Yeah. Then, you know, so in the ones that we went through last time when it talked about assisting different people or doing certain action, it means you have to do it for a while. Yeah, I mean, if we're going to create that much merit. But, of course, if we really put in bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness, that speeds the process along. So then 206 and 207, a single sign, so the, you know, the 32 signs of a great person come from 100 times the mass of merit needed to produce all 80 marks. Okay, so the pores, to attain one pore, then the number of pores times 100, you get one of the 80 marks, then you take all of the 80 marks, the merit from that times that of 100, and that's the amount of merit for one of the 32 signs. Okay. And then through 1,000 times the vast merit that causes 30 of the marks, I think that should be 30 of the signs, not marks. Yes. Good thing I caught that. Let's change that. It's amazing the things you can read so many times and there's a mistake and you don't notice it. okay, so through 1,000 times the vast merit that causes 30 of those signs, okay, arise like the full moon, the swirl of hair between the brows. Okay, so the Buddha has that curl of hair between his brows that can stretch out, way out, beyond Mars, beyond, I don't know, all these faraway galaxies and light years that it takes. Okay, and then it can also come back in and be perfectly compact. Okay, so through 1,000 times the merit to attain all 80 of the mark, no. Yeah, through 1,000 times of the merit to attain 30 of the 32 signs, then that gives you the 31st sign, which is that curl. Okay. Then 208, from 100,000 times the merit required for the forehead swirl is produced the protector's crown protrusion, the top of which is imperceptible. You should realize that a single dharma conch of the one who possesses the 10 powers arises from the amount of merit that produces the crown protrusion multiplied 10 million times. Okay? So, you have all that merit necessary for the forehead swirl, which was 100,000 the amount for the first 30 of the signs. And then to attain the Usnisha, on the top of the Buddha's head, you need 100,000 times the merit of the forehead swirl to attain the Usnisha. Okay? Then the Dharma conch means the speech of a Buddha that possesses 60 qualities. To attain that, here the Buddha is called the one who possesses the 10 powers, because a Buddha has 10 special powers, which are described in the 5th chapter, so we'll get to it later. But we talked about them in Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. Okay. So in order to attain the Buddha's speech, then you need the amount for the Usnisha multiplied by 10 million times, which is, I calculated it, to say it in our language, where did it, the number? 10 zillion. Okay, so multiply the merit for the crown protrusion multiplied by 10 zillion is the amount of merit needed to attain the Dharmakach, which is the Buddha's speech. Okay. And we need so much more merit to attain the Buddha's speech, because the Buddha's speech is the most important aspect of the Buddha, because that's the chief way that he communicates and teaches sentient beings. Yeah, so they say for us, the Buddha's speech is the most important. The Buddha's mind, we can't communicate with directly because we're too obscured. The Buddha's body, maybe we can see the emanation bodies, but we don't always even recognize them. Yeah, but we can't see the enjoyment bodies, and sometimes we can't even see the emanation bodies. But the Buddha's speech, we can hear, and especially since he taught and the scriptures were carried down by all the Banakas and then eventually written down and published and so on, and then our teachers teach them to us, we can come in contact with the Buddha's speech. And so that's really the big way that we benefit. People sometimes, they want to see miracles or, like we just had the celebration of the Day of Miracles, because these non-Buddhists challenged the Buddha to a contest of miracles. And at first he said no. He said, what's the use? Miracle making, doing all these kind of superpowers, super knowledges or superpowers, that doesn't mean you have spiritual realizations. It could just mean that you have deep concentration that allows you to have those powers, or sometimes people even have them because of karma, past karma. So the Buddha turned these guys down and said, no, it's useless to do that. But they nagged him, and they pestered him, and they followed him everywhere. And then they taunted him, oh, you don't want to have the contest because our powers are better, blah, 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 blah. So finally, he accepted their challenge, and of course, his miraculous powers were much greater than theirs. And as in the custom in India, is if, because there were all these different groups with different teachers, is if there were a contest, if there were a debate, and your side lost, you converted to the winning side. So I think all these matted hair ascetics had to go to the barber shop. Yeah. And then they became the Buddha's disciples. Their mothers were probably so happy. Oh, you finally cut your hair. Okay. So, then 209. Thus, even though the merit is incalculable, it is said to have a, it is merely said to have a limit, just as one expresses all the regions of the universe by subsuming them in the 10 directions. Okay? So even though the collection of merit is incalculable, but it is taught to us as if it were measurable, so they, you know, gave all those kind of statistics. Okay? So, yeah, so it's, although it's difficult to know exactly the qualities of each sign and the amount of merit needed to create it and for how long, in part because it's going to depend on each person's practice. Because, you know, on Friday nights we went through all those different criteria for what makes an action strong, so they apply equally when we're creating merit. Yeah, so, you know, the field that we're doing the positive action with, ourselves as a basis, the action itself, the motivation, you know, if it's something done repeatedly or if it's something obstructed by our getting angry and having wrong views. So there's all these factors that can make merit stronger and weak. So clearly, you know, that you can't get an exact amount. And anyway, I've never, they talk about merit like this, but you know, I've never heard of a merit counter like, you know, okay, you have 3 gold stars today, Susie. So, you know, you only have incalculable -3 left to go. You know, it's not like that, so we shouldn't think of merit in that way. Okay, so, you know, the reason that he went through this whole explanation is because there's some people that want to know, you know, they want the statistics on how much merit it is. So the Gajuna gave it to them to kind of satisfy them. And, you know, and then maybe it stimulates them to create some of that merit. Okay. Yeah. So even though they may be pleased, they may be, be engrossed and be stimulated to practice the path, in actual fact, you know, we can't kind of measure this and give a perfect number that's one size fits all. Okay, now here, Khenzo Rinpoche, giving the commentary, he paused a little bit and he wanted to talk about the difference in meaning between Buddha and Arya Buddha. Okay, so this is quite interesting and actually helpful. Okay, so, because they're different. Buddha, and here I'm just saying Buddha, I'm not saying the Buddha, because the Buddha refers to Shakyamuni Buddha. So just Buddha, okay? So Maitreya talks about that in his 8th chapter of the Ornament of Clear Realizations. And so Buddha, okay, is an ultimate quality that has arisen from its cause, the fulfillment of the 2 collections. So an ultimate quality, meaning a quality of the Buddha, that's arisen from its cause, so it didn't come out of nowhere, yeah, and it didn't come from a discordant cause. It came from fulfilling the 2 collections. Okay. So when we say Buddha, what Buddha includes is the 4 Buddha bodies. Okay. When we talk about the 2 Dharmakaya bodies, the Wisdom Dharmakaya and the Nature Dharmakaya, and then when we talk about the 2 form bodies, the Enjoyment Body and the Emanation Body. Okay, you remember what all those are? Yeah. So those are all included. Each of the four is Buddha. Okay? And in general, like a Buddha's hands and arms and his 32 signs and the 80 marks, and you know, all these are also considered Buddha. And also mental qualities. They talk about 21 unpolluted wisdoms. I haven't been able to find a list of those. Do you have a list anywhere? And I've never been able to find the list of 27 enlightened activities either. It must be in some scripture. I just haven't found either of those yet. If you happen to come across them, please let me know. Okay, but all those kinds of wisdom and the different qualities of a Buddha are also considered Buddha, okay? Because it's an ultimate quality that's arisen from its cause, the two collections. Okay. Now, Arya Buddha is a person, okay? Because, you know, we talk about Aryas. Aryas are all people, aren't they? So we say Arya Buddha. So an Arya Buddha is a person. Okay. Now the enjoyment body and the emanation body, those are both persons. Okay. So like Shakyamuni Buddha was an emanation body. Here's a person. Yeah. If you go to a pure land of, you know, Vajrayogini or Yamantaka or whoever, those enjoyment bodies are persons. So remember, body doesn't mean the physical body. It means a corpus of qualities. Okay? So, an Arya Buddha is a person. Okay? So, let's look at, you know how we do the 4 points? When you have two things, you do the 4 points. And like, what's both, what's one, this one and not that one, what's that one but not this one, and what's neither? Okay, so let's do that. What is both Buddha and Arya Buddha? Yeah, Shakyamuni Buddha. Okay, so he's Buddha because he's the emanation body. The emanation body is included under Buddha. And he's also Arya Buddha because he's a person, an enlightened person. Okay. Now, what's an example of something that is Buddha but is not Arya Buddha?
His marks.
Yeah, the Buddha's marks, the 32, 80 marks, okay? Or the different kinds of wisdom that he has. So those are Buddha. Why aren't they Arya Buddha? They're not persons. Okay. Now, how about an example of something that's an Arya Buddha, but not Buddha? Is there one or is there not one? No. No, there's not one. Because everything... An Arya Buddha is the emanation body and the enjoyment body, and both of those are also Buddha. Okay. Now, what's something that's neither Buddha nor Arya Buddha? Okay. Us. Okay. So doing these things, you know, with the four, it's quite good because it helps us get a clearer understanding of the relationship between things.
Would ultimate bodhicitta be Buddha but not Arya Buddha?
Yeah, because it's a quality of the Buddha, but it's not a person, so it can't be Arya Buddha.
It's also a quality of the Bodhisattva. So
ultimate bodhicitta. Yeah. But it is a quality of the Buddha, so
it
fits.
Exclusive.
You would have to say the Buddha's ultimate bodhicitta. Okay, it couldn't be a bodhisattva's ultimate bodhicitta.
If bodhicitta is the aspiration to become awakened for the benefit of all sentient beings, I would think once you're a Buddha, you you're beyond bodhicitta.
Yeah. Now here, ultimate bodhicitta doesn't mean the altruistic intention. Ultimate bodhicitta is the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay. But that still is a question, you know, do you still have a bodhicitta when you're a Buddha? Or do you still have refuge? We say, I take refuge until I am enlightened. Does that mean once you're enlightened, you no longer have refuge? Oh, now I can go to become another religion. I'm finally Buddha. I can go, you know. Yeah. Or, you know, oh, now I'm Buddha. Oh, I can forget about bodhicitta. I don't have to care about these sentient beings anymore.
Well, you can have the great compassion, but you don't no longer have the aspiration to become enlightened. Because you become
Except you have it for other sentient beings. Yeah.
Right, but you have the aspiration for them to become enlightened.
Yeah. So you have the bodhicitta for other sentient beings. And you've become the refuge objects.
Yeah.
So. All these Buddhas doing a mass conversion, you know?
Baptisms in the Ganges.
Yeah. Now they can cuss and swear. You don't have to be compassionate anymore. Okay. Okay. So, verse 210. If the causes of a Buddha's form body are immeasurable, like we just went through, like the universe, then how could the causes of the truth body be measurable? Okay. So, you know, just as the universe is boundless, just as the collection of merit giving rise to the Buddha's physical signs is boundless, then similarly the truth, the causes for the truth body are also boundless. Yeah. So again, an amount that is so large that we can't grasp it. So, you know, if it's above 10, then. Yeah. Okay. And then 211. Yeah, so here. It's really beautiful here. If in all cases a vast effect arises from a small cause, then one should cease to believe that a measurable effect comes from the immeasurable causes of a Buddha. Okay, so, you know, if a vast effect arises from a small cause, you know, when you look out and you see our two truths trees and our three jewels trees, I mean, these trees are enormous. And they started out, I don't even know how big those seeds are. I can't even see the seeds. You know, they're really tiny. So these enormous trees started from something that big, okay? And so, you know, if we use that analogy, then we can create a small cause and get a huge result. Yeah. And so the collections of merit and wisdom are each immeasurable, and so their results are measurable. If they were measurable, and then still from a small cause you can get a great result, then the results could still be immeasurable. But here the causes themselves are immeasurable, so clearly the results are immeasurable squared. Okay, so our ordinary minds can't grok this, but it's something that the Buddha can understand. Okay, so the Buddha's qualities are inconceivable. Yeah, you know, when there's this passage in the Pali Canon where the Buddha picks up a handful of leaves and he says, you know, what I've taught you is like this handful of leaves compared to everything in the universe, you know, or what I've taught you is like everything in the universe, that I have the wisdom to know, you know, what it is. I mean, are you getting, am I expressing this well? Are you getting what I'm saying? No, that what there is, the Buddha's omniscient mind knows all phenomena, which are limitless. What he's teaching us is small, like the number of leaves in the palm of your hand. Okay?
But what he knows is like all the leaves in the forest.
Well, no, like everything in the universe. Yeah. Yeah, so even larger. But he taught us what we need to know in order to become Buddhas. He didn't teach us extraneous material that we don't need to know. You know, that's just going to get us confused. Okay, so just as the Buddha's qualities are inconceivable, so are the Dharma's qualities, you know, because it's by practicing and realizing the Dharma that the Buddha became a Buddha with inconceivable qualities. And also, after becoming a Buddha with these boundless qualities, what does the Buddha do? He teaches the Dharma, so it must be something that is also inconceivable. And then the Buddha is also a member of the Sangha. Yeah, when we talk about the Sangha jewel, it includes the Arya Buddha. Okay? So that means that the qualities of the Sangha are also inconceivable. So what this means is if you have three objects of refuge, they're all three inconceivable. The qualities are inconceivable, even though we can't fully understand them. If we generate a mind of faith based on some knowledge and, you know, reasonable conviction, then the amount of merit we create from that faith is also inconceivable. So we're not talking about blind faith here. Yeah, we're talking about faith that comes from having some kind of knowledge and awareness. And of course, the more knowledge you have of the Buddha's qualities, then the stronger your faith is going to be, the more merit you create by generating that kind of faith. Yeah. Even people, I mean, because you see sometimes the very elderly people, they have tremendous faith. They may not know a lot, but they have tremendous faith. And so it's diminishing now in the Tibetan community as, you know, the old generation of elderly die. Yeah. But especially the ones that grew up in Tibet, you know, they grew up surrounded by the Dharma. They heard things. They may not have understood things. They may not have read texts. But what they heard, they had faith in. And, you know, I mean, when you hear about great compassion, what's there not to have faith in? Okay? And so, you know, they when they're old, instead of like in our old age homes where the people just sit around and watch TV all day, they sit and they turn their prayer wheels and they say their manis. Yeah, and so it really helps their mind. It soothes their mind. It calms their mind. They're creating merit. Yeah, so it's something quite good. I just I heard a story about. Yeah, one Geshe told this story about some man in old Tibet. You know, he had committed a crime, and so he was in prison, and his whole time in prison. He had nothing to do. So what did he do is he recited manis. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. So he chanted, I think, maybe it was a billion om mani padme hum. And then when they took him away, you know, they were going to execute him or something, he said his mind was very happy and calm. Yeah, because he had spent his whole time in prison chanting that. And then all these other people who weren't in prison, you know, who think they're such big shots, were running around doing all these things, creating so much negative karma. Yeah, it's kind of interesting how that goes. Yeah, we can't judge whose life is valuable and whose life isn't just based on what the person's doing or based on their social status. Because we don't really know what's going on inside people's minds. Yeah. So many years ago, I was helping this one young man in Singapore. He was 30, 31. He was dying of cancer. And I would go to his sister's flat where he was staying. And it was, you know, one of these tall Singaporean blocks. And so one day we were sitting by the window and looking down, and of course all the cars going by and people going by. And he said, "I'm such a useless human being." And I said, "No, you aren't. You know, you have all this time. You can be thinking about the Dharma. You can be reciting mantra. You can, you know, read texts. You're an intelligent human being. Your body may be falling apart, but your mind's intact. And you have the potential to create a lot of merit, much more merit than all these people who are buzzing around beneath you who think that they're on top of the world because they're young and healthy." Yeah. So we can't judge. We can't judge. Okay, but the point of that verse was when we have faith, you know, especially faith based on knowledge or based on reasoning, then the amount of merit we have by having that faith in the three jewels is really something immeasurable, because the three jewels themselves are immeasurable. And so similarly, you know, when we make prostrations, when we make offerings, when we rejoice in the merit of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, because the field with which we're creating the karma is so rich in good qualities and has immeasurable good qualities, then the merit we create, you know, even by offering something small or making one prostration or rejoicing even for a minute or two, is enormous. Yeah. So we should, you know, think about this and, you know, and realize that any small action we do in relationship to a field of merit that is so potent is definitely worthwhile. We shouldn't kind of go, "Oh, well, that's just some small thing, not, you know, doesn't matter." Yeah, it does matter. It makes a huge imprint on our mind. Okay? Because when you really think of the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, you know, it's different than making an offering to, you know, whatever. Yeah, your high school friend or whatever. Okay, so verse 2:12. "In brief, King, the Buddha's form body arises from the collection of merit, and their truth body is born from their collection of wisdom." And then 2:13. "Thus, these two collections cause the attainment of Buddhahood. Hence, in short, always devote yourself to merit and wisdom." Okay, so all the virtuous actions required to become a Buddha, although they're inconceivable, we can subsume them in two. Okay, collection of merit, collection of wisdom. Collection of merit is the principal cause for the Buddha's form body. Collection of wisdom is the principal cause for the Buddha's truth body. So principal just means main, because actually you need both collections to attain any of the Buddha bodies. And when you become a Buddha, you attain all of the Buddha bodies at the same time, simultaneously. It's not like first you get one and, you know, then kind of there's a delay and the other one comes along. And you actualize them all at the same time. Okay, so what we need is a unified practice of method and wisdom, being able to put those together. Yeah. So, okay, we'll just finish this verse. It might take a while. Okay, so practices on the method side are practices done with the motivation of bodhicitta, motivation of renunciation, you know, and of the six perfections. They're primarily generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. They fall on the method side of the path, which is the side of the path that is involved in the collection of wisdom, a collection of merit. Thank you. And then the practices on the wisdom side are basically concentration and wisdom, which go to the collection of wisdom. And then joyous effort is needed for both of those. Okay? And so, again, because the hearers and solitary realizers lack bodhicitta, and their aspiration is for their own liberation, then although they, you know, accumulate merit and wisdom, it isn't the collections of merit and wisdom, because it doesn't bear the result of Buddhahood. Their merit and wisdom bear the result of arhatship. Okay, so it's important for us to rely on the two collections and to dedicate the merit from them for the attainment of full Buddhahood. So this verse that we chant every day in our after lunch, you know, due to this virtue, may all beings complete the collections of merit and wisdom. May they attain the two Buddha bodies resulting from merit and wisdom. So that's another verse from Nagarjuna in the 60 stanzas of reasoning. But what it's emphasizing, hopefully this verse now will mean a little bit more to us. Okay, we're saying may the virtue of whatever action we did, yeah, may it go for all beings to complete the two collections. And may they attain the two Buddha bodies that result from these two collections. So that's a pretty vast dedication, isn't it? Okay, now actually, this verse is quite long. Well, we'll start it. We'll see how far we get the explanation here. But it's quite something, this explanation. Okay, so so we always should devote ourselves to creating merit and wisdom. Even though ours isn't the actual creation of merit and wisdom right now, we should really try, you know, when before we do any kind of virtuous action, bring up the bodhicitta. At the end, think about emptiness, you know, or think about dependent arising, even just a little bit. Okay. So Gyaltsebje, in his commentary to Precious Garland, he explains this in more depth, and he does it by giving a syllogism. Okay? So, the syllogism. The subjects, the person and the aggregates, do not exist inherently because they are dependent arisings. I suggest writing this down. Okay? The subjects, you know, what we're talking about. The person and the aggregates do not exist inherently because they are dependent arisings. Okay? So what we're trying to realize is the thesis, which is that the person and the aggregates are not inherently existent. Okay? So in order to understand that, there's three criteria that you have to understand in order to have a correct inference. Okay? So the first criteria is the presence of the reason in the subject. So here it would mean the person and the aggregates being dependent and arising. So that's true. Right? So that one's fulfilled. Then the second one is the privation. So what that means is that if it's the reason, then it's the predicate. So here it would be, if it's a dependent arising, it's empty of inherent existence. True? Not true.
True.
Then the counter privation, is the opposite of the predicate, if it's the opposite of the predicate, then it's the opposite of the reason. So here, if it exists inherently, it's not a dependent arising. Okay. Actually, if you realize the first two, you don't really need the third. Actually, if you realize the second, you don't really need the third, you know. It's there, but they put it in anyway. Okay? So, this particular syllogism has two subjects, the person and the aggregates. Okay? So this syllogism is not actually designed for beginners like us. It's designed for people who have already realized emptiness because, yeah, do you have any guesses? Why? When you meditate on emptiness, which emptiness do you meditate on first? The person. Why? Because it's easier. So they say. I personally think it's harder. But they say it's easier. Okay? I told this only this once that I thought it was harder for the first. He was so surprised. I said, well, because, you know, first of all, understanding, you know, phenomena, that they're composed of parts and then designated, we grew up with a scientific explanation, you know. And so, you know, yes, everything's composed of these teeny tiny parts and there's all this space between them and you know, you see these things of, you know, when you make movies and you have all the little atoms together and then something appears out of it and you put all the cells together and, oh, there's a, you know, a body and, you know. So that doesn't seem so difficult. But we grow up in a culture, this is what I told them, maybe I was totally off base, but I'm sharing it with you. So don't take this as the Buddha's teachings. It's not, it's my opinion. But we grow up in our culture with such a strong sense of I, you know. I mean, everybody, everywhere has a strong sense of I. But especially in our culture, we're supposed to be individuals and pick ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And from the time we're very young, we have to have opinions on everything and we have to excel. And there's so much emphasis on the self in our culture. Yeah. So actually what the Tibetans say and the Indians before them is that the emptiness of the self, of the person, is easier because we already know the person's imputed, because in order to see the person, you have to see something else. You have to hear their voice or see their body, or if you're clairvoyant, know their mind. And only on the basis of that can you say there's a person. So that shows, you know, there's already a person who's imputed, at least in that simple way. So they say that makes it easier for us to realize the emptiness of the person rather than the emptiness of the aggregates. And so that's why we start out with that.
There's so much more grasping to that self than there is to grasping to phenomena.
Yeah.
Or at least not aggregates still, but yeah.
Yeah, we really grasp the self, don't we? Anyway, okay, so actually, if this syllogism were to be for somebody who was a beginner, there would only be one subject. The person is not inherently existent because it's a dependent arising. And then you would go on from there to the aggregates are not inherently existent because they're dependent arisings. Okay, so putting both of them together, it presupposes that the meditator already has a realization of emptiness. Okay. So let's pause here and see if there's questions, because once we get into the next bit, it's going to take some time. Questions, comments?
I just have a comment. Mm-hmm. When Geshe Longgao, or what's
Mm, Kensar Jamachek Chok.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, no, the one that came Thakke. Here and taught.
Geshe Thakke?
No, no, no.
Pension Rinpoche.
Wangdok, yeah.
Geshe Wangdok.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he talked about the 35 Buddha practice.
Uh-huh.
And when he talked about just saying the names and how much power that is, mm-hmm. and how much that just kills the negative stuff that we've done and how much merit we get, that just astounded me because I never thought of that side of it, you know. So like you were talking earlier, that to take into consideration the power of the objects.
Yeah.
Is, you know, it really was so helpful.
That's yeah.
when I got conviction that this actually works.
Works, right. And the same applies to saying mantras, because the mantras often contain the name of the deity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we say medicine, Buddha, Taitam, Bhikkhati, Bhikkhati, Ma, Bhikkhati, Rasa, Samgati, Soha, it has the name of the medicine Buddha in there. So it's saying the name. So if you say the name and you're not in outer space and you're trying to think of the qualities of the medicine Buddha while you say it, or Om Tari Tatari Tari Soha, name of Tara, you know, so you're thinking about the qualities of that Buddha. That's very different than saying George, 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 you know, Mary, 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 you know? It's different, isn't it? Yeah. So, but the thing is, we have to remember to use it to think of the qualities. And, you know, to a lot of these things, when we first hear them, we don't always have faith in them. I mean, you kind of heard it and it made you think, oh yes, these things have a lot of power just by saying the names of the Buddha. But, you know, people like me, I'm a little bit more hard-headed and it like took me a really long time to kind of get this. You know, it's like, well, why? You know? Why does saying that create so much merit and purify so much negativity, you know? So, you know, for many people, you really have to spend some time thinking about why does this work? How does this work? And so, you know, sometimes you accept it by looking at the scripture in which the Buddha said it, and you know that scripture is a reliable one, and, you know, there's different criteria for seeing that a scripture is reliable, it fulfills that criteria, so accept it. Or maybe just you trust other things the Buddha said because they've really jived with your own personal experience. So I know for me personally what gave me a lot of faith in this kind of thing is just the fact that the Buddha said that ignorance, anger, and attachment cause suffering. You know, whenever I would hear all these things that, you know, that I can't understand, it's like, well, yeah, he's right. Suffering comes from ignorance, anger, and attachment. So if the Buddha was right about that, then maybe he was right about these other things too. Yeah. So, but, you know, some of the more things that you have to take more on, they're the things where you have to use scriptural inference. I found those things much harder. Why? How does this work? So then, you know, you have to think about it for a while to develop some kind of faith and conviction in it. Yeah. Otherwise, kind of, you know, what's the difference between saying Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, and M-I-C-K-E-Y, you know? Lama Yeshe used to say this to us all the time, you know, when we would be doing visualizations. Yeah. He would say, what's the difference between visualizing yourself as like Chenrezi and visualizing yourself as Mickey Mouse? Now, how would you answer that question? What's the difference?
Well, for us, Chenrezi is an object of great worth.
I can't think of the carry-on.
It's just like the Sangha being an object of
Yeah. But what, why, if for you, visualizing yourself as Chenrezig, what's the difference between that and visualizing yourself as Mickey Mouse?
Chenrezig's got a lot more of the qualities I want than Mickey Mouse.
Than Mickey Mouse. What? You don't want to own Disneyland?
I didn't say
you don't want to be a superstar?
No.
M-I-C-K-E-Y.
Chenrezig can help an awful lot more people than Mickey Mouse can. No matter what Mickey Mouse has done in this world,
but some children think Mickey Mouse is more valuable than Chenrezig.
Yes, they do.
They haven't met Chenrezig.
They're
wrong. But go on a deeper level. What's the difference between visualizing yourself as one and not the other?
Well, along the lines of what she's saying, it's taking our minds to those qualities.
It's taking our minds to the quiet, but what about the mode of meditation? What's the difference? And what's the difference between visualizing yourself as Chenrezig and thinking I'm an inherently existent Chenrezig, and visualizing yourself as Mickey Mouse thinking I'm an inherently existent Mickey Mouse?
The motivation, the understanding of the nature of the phenomenon itself coming up.
When you're visualizing yourself as an inherently existent Chenrezig, are you meditating properly?
No.
So what's the difference between visualizing yourself as Chenrezig and visualizing yourself
it's
as
your exalted wisdom that's appearing as that deity?
Yeah, you have to meditate on emptiness first.
Yeah, the emptiness of Mickey Mouse still is.
You know, to do the meditation on Chenrezig properly, you have to meditate on emptiness. If you don't, and you think you're an inherently existent Chenrezig, it's not going to have a lot of effect on your mind. It's going to be somewhat similar to I'm an inherently existent Mickey Mouse. Yeah, because you're grasping at the self as being inherently existent.
So when you do the Vajrasattva retreat, and even if you don't have a lot of faith in it, but doing that 3 months, it transforms you. So
yeah.
How does that happen? If you're not really thinking of emptiness so clearly.
Well, hopefully you have some virtuous thoughts while you're doing a 3-month retreat. You're dealing with Chenrezig, yes, the power of the holy object. Yeah, but you're also imagining white light and nectar coming and purifying, and you're thinking that you're releasing your negativities. You're having a little bit of regret for all the kids you threw sand at in kindergarten. You know?
Or other things.
Yeah, or other things. Okay. But the real thing that we have to remember in Tantra is the thing about emptiness. I talked to somebody once who, she had come to a meditation course. I had knew her in the meditation course, and then I didn't see her for, I don't know, maybe a year or something. And she, when I saw her next, she told me that she had gone through a period of having some mental problems where she thought she was actually the Buddha, you know? And she thought she was an inherently existent Buddha. I mean, eventually she got over that and realized that she wasn't the Buddha and so on. But this is the problem. You know, all these people who think they're Jesus? Yeah? Or all the, you know, I mean...
The poor man.
Yeah? We have lots of people who think they're somebody special. I don't even have to think I'm Jesus. I'm just special because I'm me, you know. Why bother saying, getting the credit from somebody else, you know. But the problem in all these situations is the people that are grasping inherent existence.
So you can imagine yourself as any holy being, but as long as you see yourself as an inherently holy being, you're still grasping it, you're still grasping the self as the practice, whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why, I mean, definitely, we get some benefit even though the deity's appearing inherently existent. And sometimes our divine pride, our divine dignity is, yes, I'm an inherently existent. Yeah, please make your prostrations here to me. But yeah, really the thing is that special about Tantra is the meditation on emptiness and then the wisdom appearing in that form.
And so too, in the day when we're walking around, if we can continue to remember seeing things like an illusion, that helps to break this
right
down so much that's so ingrained.
Yeah, yeah. This is like an illusion. Or what I find is this is just an appearance to the mind. Instead of this is a real thing that's happening, it's an appearance to the mind. Yeah. It's similar to saying it's an illusion. There's nothing real there.
But then people to not get caught into, because the appearance of the mind is then not to believe that. Get into a little bit of a nihilistic thinking, because it's still function, it's still, you know,
still functions.
This little place where you can kind of go, well, it's just my figment of my imagination, when in fact it's still
saying it's an appearance doesn't mean that it's a figment of my imagination.
Those
two things are different. Okay.
If walking in the forest, it's a great practice to see an appearance to the mind or see things like an illusion. There's just so much going on. What is it anyway? It's just multiple levels of dependent arisings just moving, just continually moving.
Yeah.
This goes back to last week, that the 80 signs are a result of meditating on love.
Uh-huh.
And yet, there was this huge emphasis is on compassion as being so important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering about, that meditation can produce so many things.
Yeah. So you're saying, well, compassion is so much more important than love. So why do we get the 80 marks by meditating, the chief cause is meditating on love? Is that what you're thinking?
Not quite like that, but it's just interesting that...
That they pointed out love rather than compassion. Because I think they say that actually, if it's just love and compassion, you don't have to first generate love and then compassion, even though in the sequence of the seven cause and effect instructions, first comes love and then comes compassion. That's because love there refers to the heartwarming love that comes from seeing sentient beings as your mother. Yeah. But I think for some people, love might be easier for them to generate because compassion involves seeing suffering. And it's difficult for some people to face suffering. But love involves thinking kind thoughts and seeing beauty in others. So some people may find that easier. But in actual fact, there's not a, if you're not thinking in terms of the seven-point cause and effect, then there's no difference in terms of which one you generate first. Yeah. I mean, Maitreya Buddha, the name is Maitri, love. Yeah. So we don't say, why isn't his name Karuna Buddha? Karuna will say that. Why is he named after Maitri? He should be named after me. No, sorry, you're named after him. Well, actually, Chenrezig's, Mahakara Karuna. Yeah? We need to remind her of her namesake. Okay? So the rest of this verse we will save for next week.
May the Spirit
spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guruvatna Mandala Kamniyataya. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tens and gas of Chenasi, may it stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who've spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.